Yeah, I want to introduce this talk about creation frequently asked questions with a statement from a man called human anatomist even, Dr. David Kaufman. And he said the following: if you dispose or get rid of any possibility of a creator God, some form of evolutionary idea becomes the only possible explanation, in spite of the lack of evidence for it. Now, at Creation Ministries International, Philip and I, but we have colleagues all over the world, we call ourselves biblical creationists. That means we really start with this. This is our foundation. We have ideas and models and science, but if it's not compatible with this, the model has to either be tweaked or go altogether. This is set. This is our foundation. So, I've got a clicker here. I want to start with scriptures, and we read there in 1 Peter 3:15, in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet, do it with gentleness and respect. That last bit is there for a reason, and I know in a discussion, sometimes it can get a bit heated, but that's what we're called to do. So, as Creation Ministries International, we're predominantly an information-providing ministry to the church. We welcome people who are not yet part of the church, but mostly we speak to brothers and sisters, and we want to encourage them. And so one of the mantras that we have is get equipped, because I'm going to let you in on a secret. Philip and I don't know all the answers. That job has actually already been taken. It's the Lord who knows everything. But when you have a discussion with somebody, it's fine to say, I don't know the answer to that. It's even better to then follow up with, but it's a good point, I'm going to look into it and see what I can come up with and share it with you. And that's maybe where you can come to our website, creation.com. Or you can subscribe to our InfoByte newsletter. This is the first clipboard that you're going to see, and yes, I will do clipboards. This is free, as you can see, and it's very easy. You just put your name, your email. It is an email newsletter, so that's important, and your postcode if you want, because the next time we're in the area, not necessarily this church, we advise the people in the postcode box that we draw on a map. We don't, like the pastors, we don't want to pry people away from their Sunday services, but we do midweek meetings as well. And so maybe you have a free evening and you'd come and join us. So if you see this clipboard, Philip, please pass them around. You don't have to put your name down. You may. If you already did this morning, you can do it a second time, but you can just pass the clipboard on as well. And if you don't like it after a couple of weeks, you can unsubscribe. Still good friends. We use this information only for our ministry, so we're not going to pass that on. So those are the options. But let's move on. I've got quite a few things that I'd like to say tonight. So we're going to continue a little bit in scriptures. And we see that Paul was writing to the Corinthian church. And he was writing, now I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel that I preached to you, which you received and in which you stand, and by which you are being saved. If you hold fast to the word that I preach to you, unless you believed in vain. And he continues, for I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins. How do we know that? In accordance with the scriptures, and that he was buried and that he was raised on the third day. How? In accordance with the scriptures. And Jesus tells the people, if you believe Moses, author of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Of course, the first book of those five that are attributed to Moses is Genesis, and the first 11 chapters are the most under attack nowadays, I would say. And in those first 11 chapters, you find things as creation, the first sea, I believe, the curse, the catastrophe, the confusion, four C's right there in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. So very important. And Jesus admonishes us to believe Moses on what God had said. It's not Moses' ideas. Moses just was faithful to write down these things for the people. But we believe some things, and we don't believe other things. So counterintuitively, I'm going to start with a slide called Why Not Believe Something? And I'm going to introduce you to Georg Christoph Lichtenberg. And he said the following that you can read along in the text bubble. With most men, unbelief in one thing springs from blind belief in another. Now, evolutionists and creationists both hold their position by faith. And creationists quite readily admit that our faith, as I've already said, is that this is the word of God and we stand firm on it. Many evolutionists don't realize they too have a faith position. In fact, their view is such that creation, you can't go there. And I'm going to change the text so it actually isn't anymore a quote of Lichtenberg, but it's my quote now. With most men, belief in one thing springs from aversion to another. And I think that applies for many evolutionists, that they just have an aversion not only to creation, but to the creator. They don't want there to be a creator, because what? If there truly is a creator, then we are accountable to him for our lives, for the things that we do, say, and think. And many people don't like that. They want to live their life their way. But we are asked, or actually instructed, to test everything. And that goes to Origins as well. It says in the first book of Thessalonians, test everything and hold on to the good. How do we know what is good if it's about the past? We don't have a TARDIS, do we? If you do, let me know. I want to have a go. But can we test the past? Well, Philip already touched on this morning. Tests are done in the present. So when you see people in lab coats, that's the stereotype that people have of scientists. I think you can do scientists without wearing a lab coat. But they do things in the present. Why? Because they exist in the present. If you don't exist in the present, well, maybe you're out with the fairies, but we all exist in the here and now. And we call this science that they do in labs experimental science. And the whole idea, some people call it empirical science, to use a fancy word. The whole idea is that this is all about observations and doing things over again and compare notes, repeat. That's the key structure of something that's scientific. It works today and it works yesterday and tomorrow. Oh, that's a reference to Jesus, isn't it? Yeah, he's never changing, but science of man changes a lot. Can you just think back, even a century, there was wild ideas that we've now completely discarded, and now we know better. There's a good chance that in the future, things that we believe strongly now are going to be modified or amended again. But what about evolution? What is evolution? Well, we have to look a little bit at the word itself, because, as you know, many words can have different meanings depending on the context. Somebody who shall remain nameless, but it is the pastor, he called me the chairman because I helped put one or two chairs away earlier. You see what we did there? That was a play on words. Chair, chairman. See, depending on the context, the word chair can take a different meaning. So evolution. Many people have said to me as well, evolution just means change. No, I'm not talking about that kind of change that's maybe in your pocket just now, but something being a little bit different from the rest of the population, and maybe that change will then propagate or take over the population. And to just use a simple example, you are all familiar with this change because you've seen people walk their dogs. At lunch, over lunch, after lunch, we were talking about robots maybe walking our dogs. I think that's pointless. But this kind of change we do see, yet we all recognize these as dogs. They look very different. And I think the middle one is a Great Dane there. So when people say evolution is change, it's not very hard to make that case, is it? Because when I look with my daughter through my photo album and my baby pictures, I do realize that I have changed. In fact, all of you have changed. So there you go, I've converted us all to evolutionists now, according to that definition. But if a definition explains everything, it really doesn't explain anything, does it? So evolution means change, yeah, very easy to show, but doesn't really hold much water in my opinion. But yet they use it because they say, well, creatures change all the time, this is well observed, therefore evolution, in the sense of meaning change, is true. And therefore they then conclude and take a leap of faith and want you to take that leap with them. Therefore, we descend from a common ancestor. Voila, evolution. Evolution in this slide is used in more than one meaning. Let me continue to explain it. When a word is used in an argument with different meanings, we call that, here's a good Scrabble word for you, an equivocation. It's a fallacy. And here you see a picture of four birds. I'm not an ornithologist or anything, but for me, they do look quite alike. It turns out that three of them are actually in the same species. By the way, a little side note, these dogs that you see here, not only do they belong to the same species, they all belong to the same subspecies, Canis lupus familiaris. So they're actually a subspecies, yet they look so different. Anyway, back to the birds. These, to me, I'm not a trained one, look similar. And we have no problem as creationists with these. In fact, these can breed and have little eggs out of which baby birds come. But the evolutionists want you to believe in a different type of change. They want you to believe that a small theropod dinosaur, over long periods of time, turned into a flying bird. So on the left, we have this evolution observed, which creationists don't have a problem with. But on the right, there is the imagined evolution that somehow one kind of creature can change into a completely different kind of creature. And we can talk about the impossibility of that change. But yet, with good artists and a good story, you can come a long way, apparently, because there's many evolutionists that believe that this actually happened. So tonight, I'm going to try and cover most, if not all, of these topics. Natural selections, did the animals fit on the ark? What about dinosaurs? Some of these Philip has already touched on. How to make a fossil? I'm going to dwell a little bit longer on that because we got good books about fossils. Cain's wife, we're going to talk about that. And then at the end, I'll close with bad things and good news. So natural selection, some people think that is the same as evolution. And therefore, maybe they believe, well, you show evidence of natural selection, that means you've shown evidence of evolution. So we need to remember that word evolution. What type of evolution? Is it the observed variation or the imagined extrapolation? So that's imagining things that are not justified, that don't come from the science. So observation, we already said, it has to do with the scientific method. Observe, repeat, have other people observe and repeat. And actually, natural selection was a word or was a term that a creationist was using a quarter of a century before Darwin published his book on the origin of species. It was a man named Edward Blyth, as you can see in that quote. So, no, we creationists, we're not opposed against natural selection. We write articles about that as well. But this natural selection is observed in the present. No, then this other picture where we have the change from a dino into a bird, that's the imaginary thing. This is all based on a belief, a worldview, a paradigm, an ideology, if you like. And this is all about the past. Now, once again, I want to stress, creationists have views about the past too, but it's inspired by the Word of God, not our own opinions. So let's look at an example of natural selection that has been used for many, many years in school textbooks, and it's about the peppered moths. And there is, in this image, four of them. I'll put the arrows so you can see the two light ones and the two dark ones. I think if you can see them, you might want to see an optician, but it is hard. They are quite well hidden. So they have a fancy Latin name, which I'll spare you of, but there it is. Now, what's the story about the peppered moths? These things existed, and they used to live, so they say, or rest on tree trunks. There's a whole story there, but that's beside the point. The lighter ones were predominantly the larger number in the population of peppered moths, and they used to sit on light-colored trees, such as birches. That means that the birds that would like to eat these moths couldn't really see them well. But the fewer darker ones, they stood out from the trees that were light. And so the birds would prey on the darker ones. But then came the Industrial Revolution. And with the Industrial Revolution back in the day, there was a lot of emissions going out in the air, a lot of pollution. And it turns out that the soot that was emitted into the air and into the environment started to make the trees and the plants darker with all the soot. And so the darker moths were no longer observed so well by the birds, but the lighter ones stood out against the darker tree trunks now. So now the lighter ones were being eaten. And this was observations made, and therefore the darker moths became more prevalent and the lighter moths less. And the claim was, and this is what textbooks have been using for years and years, that this is evolution by natural selection. Hang on a second. What kind of evolution? Because remember, that word can mean more than one thing. Is it the evolution that we observe? Or is it the evolution that they want you to believe? Now, I'm going to repeat what I've just told you two more times. I'm going to use it first with pictorials. This was the peppered moth population before. Mostly light-colored, a little bit of dark-colored. Then the Industrial Revolution came, and the background, the trees where these moths were sitting, became darker. And now the lighter moths were standing more out, and the darker moths were difficult to spot by the birds. So the population shifted from mostly white to mostly dark moths. So we went from this to this. And then when people started to become more aware of pollution and such, and less emissions were going out, the population started to shift back to the lighter ones. All this change has been observed and documented by mankind. So for the third time now, I'm going to share this story with you, and I'm going to want you to spot where the evidence for evolution is. So read with me. One, before the Industrial Revolution, there was genetic information for dark and light moths. Yeah? During the worst days of pollution, there was genetic information for dark and light moths. Still with me? Today, there is genetic information for dark and light moths. There you go, there's the proof of evolution. Any question? Do you see what I'm doing there? This is the data. These are the observations. But some people spin that in such a way in the textbooks in schools to try to confirm that evolution has happened from molecules to man, from some ape-like ancestor that over 6 or 7 million years became a human being. This is simply natural selection. Creationists have no problem with it. It's observable. What evolutionists need to do is not about the survival of a light or a dark moth. They need to explain the arrival of any moth. They need to explain where it got its wings, where it got its antennas, where it got the shading of its wings. That's what they need to explain. Now, we have some skeptics, and Philip mentioned this, that ask questions. And sometimes they're quite sure of themselves. All the animals could not fit on the ark. Well, if we keep drawing arcs like this, then no, they are certainly having a point. So we should probably consider ditching those books from our children's ministries. But when somebody says all of the animals could not fit onto the ark, and we can make an analogy, we could say all of the people could not fit in that building. What are some of the questions that you would need to know the answer to be able to say such a thing? Well, I'm sticking with the ark analogy, but you can fill in your own analogy. How big was the ark? And we'll read in the Bible that the ark, God told Noah to make it 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. People who were there here this morning learned that a cubit is from your elbow to the tip of your finger. Usually, it's about 17 inches. Because it's the cubit of an adult man. If you take a young child, of course, you're going to get quite a different measure. In metric, I'm from mainland Europe, by the way, so 137 meters, or if you like imperial, 450 feet long, give or take a few. So that's the size of the ark. What is another question that you need to know the answer to be able to state all the animals could not fit on the ark? Well, how many animals? Well, we read in the scriptures that of the birds according to their kinds, animals according to their kinds, creeping things of the ground according to their kinds, two of every sort shall come into you. There's an interesting statement, by the way. Noah and his family didn't have to go out and hunt or chase all these animals down. God sent the ones that he wanted to save to Noah and his family. It was a miracle. Animals, most animals don't tend to flock towards people. Certainly not if they have to leave their preferred habitat. But they did, because God was orchestrating this. Anyway, I digress. You might say, Lucien, it's pulling teeth. How many animals? Okay, some creationists have done some work, and they worked out that it's probably 8,000 different kinds that had to go on the ark. So multiply that by two, because you need a male and a female, despite of whatever nonsense you hear in the news today. 16,000 individuals, plus a few extra, because for the clean ones, Noah needed to take 7 or 14. You can ask me about that later. By the way, in the Q&A, there's two rules. Questions end in a question mark, and the other rule is that difficult questions are for Philip, easy ones for me. So, are you in agreement that those two parameters you need to know the answer to? To answer the question, can all the animals fit? Well, let's translate it. All the people don't fit into that building. You would have to ask, how many people are we talking about? What building are we talking about? When it comes to Noah and his ark, do you think that most skeptics know the answer to these questions? More often, they don't. They don't know how big the ark was. They don't know how any animals needed to be there. But they are absolutely sure that it couldn't have fit. That could solicit a chuckle, because that's funny how they can be so dogmatic without knowing these two answers. So the ark was huge, and the animals went in side by side. Well, didn't say side by side, but two by two. Land-dwelling, air-breathing animals. So that's another question that Philip already gave the answer to. He didn't have to take swimming creatures, fish, whales, dolphins, because there was lots of water going about. Yes, a lot of swimming creatures did die because it was catastrophic, but quite a few of them did survive. So no fish tank required on the ark. What about dinosaurs? Usually I do a bit of interaction here, but we move on. Simple, dinosaurs on the ark. They either were or they weren't. So yes or no? Well, at CMI we believe, go to the scriptures. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. And then in the next verse, there's the different groupings of animals. And every beast, according to his kind, livestock, according to kind, creeping things, birds. You notice that there's four categories there. He doesn't list the cat kind and the dog kind and the horse kind, because the text would have been a lot longer. If we believe the creationist, it would have to list 8,000. But he puts them in groups. So what group would the dinosaurs arguably fit in? I think they would fit quite well with the beasts. And we have evidence that dinosaurs went on the ark, and here it is. Well, joking aside, cute as that picture is, of course, we do believe dinosaurs went on the ark. Now, we saw this morning the sauropods. Some of the largest dinosaurs found are sauropods, but dinosaurs are reptilians, and many reptiles continue to grow throughout their life. You've probably seen documentaries about tortoises or turtles. The bigger they are, the older they are. But even those tortoises started off quite small and lived to be much bigger. So what did God do? Did he send the biggest reptilians, dinosaurs? No, God would have sent younger ones. They are smaller, therefore they need less food, and they are fitter. And what do I mean with that? Well, think about it. What was the purpose of Noah's flood and specifically the ark? To have different kinds survive so they could what? Fill the earth again after the flood was finished. So if the oldest reptilians are the biggest, would God have sent Granny and Grandpa Dinosaur? No, I believe he would have sent younger ones that would fulfill that commission to fill the post-flood world, i.e. have little ones. And remember, all dinosaurs started from eggs. Here you see a Komodo dragon, which itself also comes from an egg. And in fact, you started like an egg, a fertilized egg. I can't do it because it's too small to show. But we all started super small. 9 months later, we were significantly bigger. And now we are bigger still. Some of us still have to grow a bit by the looks of it, but in good time. So all creatures started small. I'm not saying, by the way, that God rolled eggs to Noah and his family. He had juvenile dinosaurs of each kind go to Noah and his family. And we do find dinosaur fossil eggs, the largest about 2 feet long, so 60 centimeters for you metric fans. We have seen dinosaurs after the flood, we believe. Not Philip and I, but people. And I want to talk to you about that in recent history. So we have a series of books, Untold Secrets. This one we don't have with us today, but I want to talk to you about George and the Dragon. Not whether that story is true or not. I want to talk to you about art for 2 minutes. Here you see a painting that you can find in my country, the Netherlands, in a castle called De Haar. And this painting is about 1440 AD. It shows George on his stallion, damsel in distress in the background. And George is fighting off some reptilian. Now, I was rubbish at drawing in school. I always got very low marks and I wasn't very artistic. But I look at this and I think, yeah, the person who made this knows how to draw a horse, a man, a woman, very accurately. So this person was competent. Now, I'm not really sure what that thing at the bottom is. But if this artist is competent, it could draw something else by simply seeing it or getting a very good eyewitness record told to him or her. And some people have said that this might be a Sylophus bori, a little dinosaur. The same story is narrated in an even better piece of art. This is a tapestry which you can find in Barcelona, where I used to live. And you have the very same components, man, horse, lady, and some reptilian creature. Wow, what a piece of art this tapestry is. All very accurately depicted. But what is that thing on the bottom? I'm not sure, but whatever it is, I believe the artist is competent to make it accurately. And some people have said that this might be a Nothosaurus. I'll leave that for you to judge. More dinosaur evidence. Dinosaur tissues. Tissue, and I'm not talking about this kind of tissue. No, not at all. I'm talking about this kind of tissue. Soft tissue in the sense of biomolecules or organic molecules. On the left, we see blood vessels, and on the right, we see red blood cells. And these were coming from a T-Rex femur. So the femur is the thigh bone. It's one of the biggest bones in the body of the dinosaur. The person who found these, well, her team anyway, they were so not believing their eyes that they repeated the test 17 times before they were willing to go public with it, because this was controversial. Remember that in the evolutionist mind, or those who believe in the millions and billions of years, dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. Yet here we see organic tissue and organic, well, not molecules, but you see the red blood cells and the vessels. This was a shock to the scientists and those who believe in millions of years, because for all this time they thought, no, anything that's in a dinosaur has to be completely mineralized, i.e. turned to stone. But yet, this is not the only find. In fact, Mary Schweitzer made a whole career out of these kind of finds. And other peoples have done what? They've done their own research and repeated, and they are finding the same things. So there's now a big debate among evolutionists or all earthers. And here you see the two of them arguing. And one of them says, no. It's something else. It has to be. It cannot be millions of years old. And then the other one, in which we can find that camp, Mary Schweitzer, that I showed you the pictures of, said, no. This is original. This came from the T-Rex femur bone. Therefore, it must be millions of years old. May I suggest to you there might be an alternative position in this whole debate? Maybe we can just come and say, excuse me, hello. We believe it's original from that T-Rex dinosaur femur bone, but it's only thousands of years old. And when I say thousands, I mean 4,400 years, roughly the time of Noah's flood, when many of these fossils were formed, we believe. Which brings me to the next section of fossil formation. How do you preserve some organic creature so well? Because if you're anything like me, you probably have forgotten to put the milk back in the fridge, especially on a warm summer day. The next day, it's not going to be smelling so fresh, is it? And that's just one day for a carton of milk. How do we preserve beautiful fossils like we see here, and Philip showed a few this morning, and I'm going to show you more. Well, the evolutionary story when it comes to fossil formation is something like this. Taking a fish, it dies, it slowly sinks to the bottom where it lays, and it slowly gets covered by sediments. And then the soft parts of the fish, they rot away, they decay, and you are left with the hard parts, the bony parts. Well, I'm afraid it doesn't work like that. Well, I'm not really afraid. It doesn't work like that. What happens? Well, fish do die. It's true. And often, not always, because of the chemistry that happens in the decay process, they can float to the surface of the water. And here's some pictures of different water creatures that are bobbing about at the surface of the water. And if you look at the top left picture, yeah, it's just visible still. There's a floating whale with a shark trying to take a bite out of the side of this whale. So the whale must be thinking, oh, there is such a thing as a free lunch after all. And that happens because fish do die. And guess what? Predators, scavengers come and start nibbling at it. The decay process, the rotting starts, and the soft parts are disappearing. Either they rot away or they're eaten away. And you are indeed left over with the hard parts, the bones. But guess what? These bones that are now more dense than water, they do sink. But they are no longer held together because all the soft parts that were holding them in place, that's been rotted away and eaten away. So the bones will sink but start to spread out. Actually, if you want a technical term, it calls the bones become disarticulated, spread out. Whereas the picture that I showed you here, at the bottom, that's an articulated fossil it would become. Anyway, so let's look at this in pictures. Here you have a unsuspecting fish, minding its own business, just swimming along. And then something catastrophic happens. An underwater avalanche full of mud and sediments takes him by surprise and covers him and buries him rapidly. And yes, we've drawn layers there because what happens is that layers are formed. If you have flowing water with sediments, layers are deposited. There are YouTube clips that you can see this happening in experimentation that people can repeat and observe. So the layers form in flowing water if the sediments in the water. Now here you have a perfectly viable fish. All the parts are in the right place. Only problem is it's dead. And yes, it's true, the soft parts tend to decay and rot away. And you are left with the hard parts. And just for fun, we've drawn some interesting teeth there as well. Teeth are among the hardest parts in most creatures, animal, but the bones with the fish is, of course, what we're looking at. It's an articulated fossil. This is how you get such beautiful preservation, because it was rapidly done. And I want to show you some examples of those things. What about fish frozen in time? You know what we're looking at here? We're looking at a fossil of 257 fish, and they are in formation. But they are all dead. It's a fossil. So there is a paleontologist who I think has a set of glasses of millions and millions of years. And so his worldview is slowly and gradually Here's what he says. I can't picture a three-dimensional school of fish sinking to the bottom and maintaining all their relative positions. It makes no sense to me. Well, quite right, it doesn't make sense to me, and it shouldn't make sense to anyone that they would all die at the same time and sink in formation. Some fish do swim in formation, but what to me is more likely of happening that something catastrophic overtook this shoal of fish and buried them all rapidly as they were swimming along. Here's another version of what Philip showed you this morning, a fish having its lunch. Do you think it swam around with its lunch in its mouth for a long time or then laid down to be slowly buried? I think it's more plausible that something rapid and catastrophic happened. And what do we see here then? Well, we see two things. One of them is quite clear, ripple marks. Where do we find ripple marks? Well, typically on the beach. Ripple marks are made in flowing water, and you see them on the beach. The problem is you have things that destroy the ripple marks. Typically, it's children with their shovels or some pesky dog running through your thing, or there's people walking, there's rain, there's wind, or a big freak wave that washes in more sand. You don't normally preserve ripple marks. They are made, they disappear, they're made again, repeat, repeat. But what are these round things that you see there? Those are fossilized jellyfish. And as you might know, jellyfish don't have hard parts. And typically jellyfish, you probably have seen some dead ones lying on the sea or somewhere. They don't stick around long, do they? So there's another paleontologist, a person who studies old fossils, old bones, and he said this about it. You never get soft-bodied preservation, soft-body being jellyfish, in that kind of coarse grain size. So that's speaking about the layer that they are found in. To preserve a jellyfish, that's hard because it has no hard parts. Something is there we don't understand. They don't understand because their worldview tells them that it's all slowly and gradually. Whereas creationists would say, no, something catastrophic happened rapidly. To me, that makes much more sense than their slowly and gradually. And in fact, Charles Darwin had an opinion about this as well because he wrote, there is no organism wholly soft can be preserved. Guess you were wrong, Charlie. It can. Now, Philip mentioned briefly this creature. This is an ichthyosaur, which translates literally as a fish lizard. And here you have one. In fact, there's two. If you look very closely, you might see that this is a mother and a baby. This is a beautifully preserved fossil of something that should be beautiful but became tragic, that this mother ichthyosaur and her baby were quickly, rapidly buried and became fossilized together. That doesn't speak of slowly and gradually to me. It speaks about quick and disastrous and catastrophic. Here's another ichthyosaur fossil. It's a skull, and it's preserved in 3D, and as you can see on the right-hand side of the picture, it penetrates multiple layers. Now, according to some people in the world, these layers represent a time span of about 1 million years. So then my question would be, are we to believe that this ichthyosaur crashed through several layers of stone? No, they would say that's not the case. We don't believe that, the evolutionists would say. They would say these layers were still soft when this happened. My follow-up question would then be, these layers were still soft after 1 million years? That seems unlikely to me. I've got a daughter, she's 6, she likes to play with Play-Doh. If she forgets to put the lid back on, what happens to the Play-Doh or to the plasticine? It becomes hard and less pliable. You're telling me that rocks can stay soft for 1 million years? That doesn't seem likely to me. Now, earlier we mentioned, I think somebody mentioned anyway, polystrate fossils, and this is a polystrate fossil. Poly meaning many or multiple, and strate is from the word strata, it means the layers that we find, so many or multiple layers. And we find polystrate fossils also in the forms of trees, in this country and other places as well. Are we to believe that a tree grew through the layers of rock? Well, again, no, say the evolutionists. That doesn't seem likely. My follow-up question would then be, oh, so it stayed up for thousands and tens of thousands of years for the layers to slowly build up. That doesn't seem likely to me, but there's a man called Derek Ager. He certainly was not a fan of biblical creationists. He recognized that that is what must have happened. And in his book, he wrote, "We cannot escape the conclusion that sedimentation was at times very rapid, i.e. sometimes these layers get built up really quickly." But he continued to believe in the millions and millions of years. How? Well, he said, well, you had times of rapid sedimentation, and then you had long periods of nothing really happening, and then you had another quick succession of layer formation. The perfect example of eating your cake and having it, but the other way around. You know what I mean. I usually just eat cake. Anyway. So, let's talk briefly about genetics, and that links into another question that we deal with in the Creation Answers book. Who was Cain's wife? I think it was maybe more a question that prevailed in the Americas, but maybe you've heard of this, because it says that Cain went to the land of Nod and knew his wife. And then the question usually is, oh, where did she come from? Did they meet on Facebook or something? Now, the skeptic likes to use this as a gotcha question to the Christian. But when we get asked about biblical characters, biblical persons, or biblical places, where do we need to turn to go and find answers? Suggest we go here first. And we read in Genesis chapter 5, verse 4, that the days of Adam after he fathered Seth were 800 years. And he had other sons and daughters. Yes, we are familiar with Cain, Abel, and Seth, because those three are mentioned. But do you think that if you live for 900 years plus, and guys, just between us, married to the only perfect woman to have ever existed in the entire universe, ladies, I'll flip it back as well, married to the only perfect man to have ever lived, you think you're going to live for 9 centuries plus and have 3 children? I suspect they have more, and it turns out the Bible does teach that there were sons and daughters. So what's the answer to the question? Cain, or at least one of the men, would have had to have married a sister. Now, before you start stoning me, just bear with me, because I know that you cannot marry your sister. In most countries, maybe even all, that's not allowed anymore. But what happened? Well, we're talking about the book of Genesis, the very beginning, early days. But some 2,500 years later, God was talking to Moses again. And in Leviticus chapter 18, we read that none of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. And adults, you can interpret that yourself now. I am the Lord. So something that was allowed in the beginning, now in the book of Leviticus, is said no more. No longer is this okay. Why did God say that to Moses? Let you in on another secret. God knew something that people didn't. Yeah, I know, it's a shock. But let me explain to you a little bit of genetics in a simple form. When you have a mother and a father coming together, they both bring a set of genetic information. And we speak about genes, for instance. Not the ones that I'm not wearing now, but you know what I mean. Genetic genes. And so if you have mutations, it is very possible, very likely even, that you have the same mutations as your family, your close relatives. So when two people from the same family that are closely related come together, they both can bring a mutated or a copying mistake of a gene to the equation. And so you now have two bad copies of the same gene, and what will likely happen is that this gene is badly expressed in the child, which means there can be a disease or a deformity. But if you have a bad copy of that gene and you marry somebody who's further distance, not closely related, there's a good chance that they have a good copy. And a lot of the times, the good copy supersedes the bad copy, and there is no deformity or no disease expressed in the child. God knew that with the universe being cursed, copying mistakes were happening all the time. In fact, I've read recently somewhere that per day you have about 1 million copying mistakes in your genes. Good thing that we have got repair system, thanks to our mighty God who has ensured that we didn't implode very, very shortly. But this is why God said, no longer are you allowed to marry close relatives, because you're going to have a lot of trouble with bearing offspring. And you probably are familiar with the fact that royalties in Europe particularly like to marry other royal families. And what did you see? You had a lot of children with problems because there was basically inbreeding going on. And you see that with small animal populations as well. Anyway, continuing with the story, let's look at some genetic evidence for the most recent female ancestor. It's only good to start with the ladies first. That's how I was brought up. But here you see a simplified picture of what we call, it's not a jacket potato in case you're thinking, it's a cell. It's a cell. And you have lots of cells in your body, trillions upon trillions. We're going to talk about a thing that you see enlarged there, a mitochondrium. That's basically like the battery pack or an energy factory for the cell. And there's hundreds of them in a cell because your cell is super active. It needs lots of energy. Now, these mitochondria, they have their own DNA. So that's not the DNA that tells you whether you have blue eyes, blonde hair, brown hair, no hair. No, but they have their genetic information. And people wanted to find out about these mitochondrial DNA information. So they went around the world investigating the mitochondrial DNA of different women from different people groups. And they came to a conclusion, before I give you the conclusion, this is passed on from mother to child. So all of you, including me, we have our mitochondrial DNA from our mom, okay? So they studied all these women around the world, and they came to the conclusion that we all come, all people alive today, descend from one female ancestor. They even called this person mitochondrial Eve. It's not because these were Bible-believing Christians, by the way. They came from secular universities, but that's the name that they gave to this person in the past. I'm quite happy with that name, by the way. Why? This doesn't prove that the Bible is true, but it is perfectly consistent with what the Bible is teaching. Let me show you. Here you see a depiction of two people at the top, Adam and Eve. And the white line represents mitochondrial DNA passed on from the mother to the child. Now, I confess I should have drawn a line also to the boys, but it would be a lot of white lines and it would be a messy picture. So I've been economic with lines. The Dutch are known for being economic sometimes. So this is what's happened. Top, Adam and Eve, and there would have been more children. But this is what the data represents. This is what they discovered from traveling around the world. This is compatible with your Bible. But they said, no, but that's not the whole story. The whole story is this. There used to be many more women that lived back in the day that all had children. The problem was all of their families became extinct. And only the family of this one woman in the middle still exists today. And you and I are all part of this family from this one woman at the top. But hang on a second. This is the data compatible with your Bible. This is the narrative. Believe it if you want. But it doesn't bear from the science, from the data. This is the data. Right, so let's move on quickly to the men. We're going to talk about the Y chromosome. So I already told you, mom and dad both bring a set of DNA chromosomes 23 to the table. So there's 23 pairs. The last pair, bottom right, is the sex chromosome. Men have an XY. Women, sorry, you're not part of this slide. You have two X's. I could get locked up for saying that, couldn't I? Anyway, we're going to talk about this Y chromosome. So it is passed on from father to son, okay? And secular scientists went traveling around the world investigating the Y chromosome from all these different men around the world. And they concluded that all men alive today descend from one male ancestor. They even called him Y chromosome Adam. Wow! I could have come up with that. Well, actually, I've read my Bible once too many times. I would have probably called him Y chromosome? Noah. You can ask Philip about that later if you want. It's because three sons and the daughters-in-law were the ones from which the whole world was populated. That's why I would say Y chromosome Noah. Anyway, again, it doesn't prove the Bible to be true, but it is perfectly consistent with. Now, I'm going to go to my last section now because I've given you a ton of information and maybe your brains on a Sunday evening are being fried as I speak, so we need to start wrapping up. Why does bad stuff happen? I don't think I need to argue that bad stuff does happen. Just open a newspaper, turn on the telly, whatever it is. There's a lot of death and suffering, isn't there? Tragedies are compounded every day, day in, day out. It doesn't seem to stop. It is relentless. That's because we live in a cursed universe. It wasn't like that in the beginning. Let me show you a picture. These are sedimentary layers. Creationists and evolutionists agree that the vast majority of these are laid down by water. Sometimes volcanic activity, but most of them are laid down by water. There's no argument. The difference is, we believe some 4,500 years ago, many people believe, millions of years and millions of years and long periods of time. What do we find in such sedimentary layers? Fossils, of which you've seen quite a few now. Fossils are what? Many fossils are dead things, dead creatures. But the fossils don't just bear out death, they bear out pain, killing of one another, disease, thorns, struggle, suffering, extinction. All of these words, one way or another, are gleaned from different fossil finds. And I can tell you more about it, but I'm running out of time. Now let's look at that picture that Philip had up this morning. Some ape-like creature some 6-7 million years ago, over many generations of death, somehow led to the existence of mankind. Look at the arrow of death pointing in one direction. This is the evolutionary story. A process of death leads to mankind. Look at the creation story. Adam existed in a perfectly good created world. It was his action of eating the fruit, the disobedience, the original sin, that brought death into the world. Look at the arrow. It's pointing in a different direction. These views, evolution and creation, they are not compatible, despite people in the church trying to merge them together. The arrow of death points the opposite way. But there are people who write books, even in the evangelical churches. One of them is Dennis Alexander. Creation or evolution? Do we have to choose? His view is no. I would say, yes, you must choose, but choose wisely. And some of you are old enough to know where that statement came from, if you had a telly in the time anyway. If you have two opposing worldviews, you cannot hold both of them without being a little bit disconnected in those views. And it underlies the theology of the gospel